Okay. Thanks again to Yael for hosting, and thanks to y'all for coming. We thought, weren't sure if you were going to have it tonight, but we wanted to just get this done already and just finish our last Shemitah. I think we'll hopefully have some review shiurim of Shemitah topics probably during the year next year, most probably like after Sukkot's time. We'll see exactly when, maybe Motzei Shabbos every, you know, once a month or something like that for maybe men and women. We'll have to figure it out, but there's a lot here to go over and, you know, a lot to be aware of during the year, especially some of the details of, you know, the food stuff, which we haven't really gone through. We spoke about a lot of things generally, but some of the very detailed questions of what they're actually going to be doing in this store and other things like that, so we haven't really spoken about. So we'll definitely have other opportunities during the year to hopefully continue to learn about Shemitah. For tonight, I just wanted to finish up some of the gardening issues. The last 2 weeks, we've been speaking about different questions of gardening, making your fruits hefker. That's what Rav Daniel Rosenfeld spoke about. Questions of cutting some of your branches. Last week, I spoke about watering and about weeding. We're not going to go into the details now because we did it already, but basically, we spoke about most opinions talking about minimizing the amount of watering that you do, but you have to have enough to make sure that your things don't die. We spoke about the different opinions about how much that is and how to do it. Is it better to do it by hand or by sprinkler, computerized water system before Shemitah? We spoke about all those things. If you want to need to review it afterwards, I'm glad to review it afterwards. And we spoke a little bit about weeding, how to do that. What are the better preferred methods of weeding if you have to weed during Shemitah? We mentioned that it's better to do it before Shemitah if you can do it before, but if you have to do during, we said there's differences of the way to do it. It's better to kill the weeds with spray rather than actually pull them out of the ground. That's what we spoke about, etc., etc. So for tonight, the last couple things we didn't get to yet were a couple other gardening activities, which we'll talk about now. Some questions about water in the garden, not in terms of watering, but random water that might happen to spill into your garden from other ways, which we'll speak about that a little bit. And at the end, you can't go the night before Tisha B'Av, you can't go giving a shiur with that, some reference to Tisha B'Av. So maybe we'll spend a few minutes talking about some of the connections between Tisha B'Av and Shemitah, which there are, definitely are a few of them. So let's start. Again, I apologize, no sheet for tonight, but I have an outline I can send out afterwards if you'd like. Okay, so question number one for tonight in terms of gardening. So what's the story with fertilizing? I don't know how many of you actually do fertilizing in your gardens or your gardener does on a regular basis, but it is something that definitely, you know, is done. And the question is, how does it work in terms of Shemitah? So fertilizing is in Hebrew is called, there's different terms for it. In the Mishnah Hebrew is called Zibul. I think modern Hebrew there's a different word for it, if I remember correctly. I think sometimes they call it Dishun. Right? I think it's Dishun is the word they usually use in the books. So in the Mishnah they talk about fertilizing as being usher to do during Shemitah. And the reason, of course, is that fertilization helps the soil grow. So that's definitely usher. The Mishnah says, if you remember those of you who were here last week, so the Mishnah says that all these things are usher drabanan, meaning that aside from harvesting, aside from planting seeds and planting trees, we said that everything else is only usher drabanan during Shemitah. And we said that's the basis for a lot of the leniencies that we have. Fertilization as well is included in that, meaning it's only usher drabanan. And therefore, we mentioned last time, a very important principle of Shemitah of gardening, which you may be familiar with. We said that Shemitah gardening is generally anything which is usher drabanan is going to be usher if it's done for the purpose of helping your garden, helping the fruit or the trees grow. But if it's done only to preserve so that, let's say, the grass or the trees or whatever won't die, so then it's permissible. And that's the basis, again, for all the things we mentioned last week, the watering and everything else. We said that it's permissible if otherwise they're going to die, they're going to lose out, so then it's permissible to maintain or to preserve. So here also, you know, just because some of you were here last week. Yeah.
Something that a gardener could
tell you? Depending which thing.
Exactly how much.
It's, you're right, it's not, we mentioned last week, it's not exact. It depends on what you have, where you grow, you know, what time of year, what you're growing, et cetera, et cetera. Your gardener can help you, but there are certain guidelines, depending on which. So what they say, again, it depends on which kind of plants or trees you have. Yeah, so basically what they usually say, again, there are different estimations of how often you have to do it. Best thing is to talk to your gardener. I think last week Liz Garfinkel told me that she was her own gardener, so she was giving me her own suggestions. I don't know if you have somebody else who comes or whatever, but you talk to them. A gardener who's, you know, a Yirei Shamayim, who knows, you know, who can talk honestly about these things. Generally, again, you know, a couple times, you know, once a week maybe. Usually what they say is if you water twice a week, so then you can water once a week. You know, if you water for an hour, maybe you can water for 45 minutes, a half an hour. But we spoke about last week a little bit that it's not exact, and it could be that, you know, once you start watering, if you only water once a week, it could be you can water for just as long as you water normally. Well, I'm not going to go into the details again. We spoke about that last week. I can tell you afterwards if you want. But the idea is generally that you shouldn't get to the point that it's already dying. Meaning, you get to the point before it would be too far that it would start to, you know, dry out or to die. Right before that point, then you water it. And again, that's where your gardener comes in to tell you, well, if you wait this long, that's not good. But if you do it right before, you know, this amount of time, then that would be okay. That'll be the minimum. So you, what you want is the minimum amount of either watering or whatever else, the minimum amount that's needed in order to keep it alive, basically. That it shouldn't get to the risk of possibly dying. That's essentially the general rule. Again, you know, depending on the details, I can tell you what Rav Rimon says here, but it's not the same. You know, Daniel Hyman told us the very first time we had this, he said, you know, I said something Rav Rimon said here about a regular garden in Israel, so that's not always true. You know, it's true. You know, it depends on where you are and how, what you're growing, whatever it is. It's hard to give exact rules, but that's the principle. Okay. When it comes to fertilization, it's the same thing. Fertilization would be permissible during Shemitah if necessary in order to help your garden to continue to be maintained properly. However, the best thing to do is to do it before Shemitah, meaning as opposed to what we spoke about last week, watering for sure, and in some cases weeding as well. Weeding you sometimes can do at the beginning of the year and you'll be okay for the whole year, and sometimes not. Sometimes if you don't weed for the whole year, you might end up having some serious problems with your garden. And again, if it's just a question of a few weeds that'll look annoying, but it won't ruin anything, then you probably shouldn't do anything. You probably should wait. But if it's really going to ruin parts of your garden in a way that could be, you know, really seriously damaging, so then we said that you're allowed to. And the same thing here as well, in terms of fertilization, if it's something which, you know, can be done before Shemitah, it's better. So if you look in the books, Rav Rimon speaks about this, in the Katif Shvit book also, they speak about this, and there they have all the professional guidelines, which I can't tell you exactly, but essentially what they say, I don't know the names of them, but there are different types of fertilizers. There are some that you put on, they'll work right away, and some that are slow acting. So again, I don't remember the names of them, if you know better. What'd you say?
No, there's something like Osmocot, it's a slow releaser.
Right, so I don't actually remember what they're called, but that's the slow releaser, so that's probably the one that I'm speaking about. The slow releasers are the better ones to use, meaning those, again, from what I've said in the books, you have to look, talk to your gardener, but it seems to be that if you put down your slow-releasing fertilizer at the beginning of the year, and then, you know, and actually, I even have a picture of it here in Rav Rimon's book. You can see here, a little picture of the fertilizer, it's like a seed. See over here. So if you put that at the beginning of the year, it acts so slowly that it seems like it's going to be sufficient in most places for the whole year, and you don't have to do anything else during the year.
No, they're not.
I knew somebody was going to
hear.
Okay, yeah. So what happens?
No, that only lasts a few months. Because also remember, your requirements for summer and winter are very different. You don't want a fertilizer to be active the whole year.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so again, unfortunately, because I'm not a gardener, I have to admit ignorance here. But again, I saw in the Katif Shvi'at book also, and that's the one for the more professional gardeners. So they also said that, I forget, they might even have mentioned the name. I don't remember if it's the same one you're talking about.
That was just published.
This is the older edition. The new edition just came out. You got the new one?
Yeah.
The new one is like purplish, whatever.
Yeah.
So this is the older one. The new one in English did not come out yet. It's on its way, but it didn't come out yet. Yeah.
You got it today in English.
Oh, really? I guess that's not true. They told me last week it didn't come out yet, but
yeah,
I guess by
today is somewhere.
Wow, okay, I'll ask him. Yeah, no, they told me, I called Cohen last week, and they told me that the English one had a little bit of a delay and it wasn't out yet. Anyway, so Katir Shvi'at also, they also mentioned that they thought that the slow fertilizer should be sufficient for a whole year. I can't tell you who's right. Obviously, talk to your gardener. If you know already that's not true, then fine. But again, you know, the minimal amount that's needed during the year is what should be used. Anything which is, you know, the less that you can do, the better. That's the general principle based on what we were saying before. Any question? No. Okay.
I guess one question would be, so on the one hand, it's very good to work with a gardener who's Jewish and Shomer Halacha.
Right.
Would it be better for some of these things to have someone who's not Jewish be your gardener, or it doesn't make a difference because it's...
Once it's mutter, it's mutter. I mean, if it was a serious option, I guess in theory it's a little bit better, but it's not required, meaning you're not required to use a non-Jewish gardener in order to avoid questions if you're going to do only things that are mutter anyway. And even if you do things that are more questionable, even if it's the non-Jew doing it, if it's your garden, that's still a problem. You know, still some of the questions we spoke about causing the land to work, and Amir al-Nakhri, just like Shabbos, Amir al-Nakhri is a problem. So for Shemitah also, there are serious problems with Amir al-Nakhri. Again, if it's something which is crucial and necessary, especially for the economy, for professional, you know, grow vegetable and fruit growers, then already that's more of a question. So then already there's more room to be making if you're talking about things which are also d'oraisa for a Jew, but for a non-Jew, you know, there's more room to be making if it's necessary, because otherwise the economy won't function. So that already, then we do talk about asking a goy. But for a private garden, generally, you don't rely on those types of leniencies as a regular rule, as a general rule. So I think in that case, I wouldn't go there. I would say, you know, whatever is mutter to the minimum could be mutter, even, you know, we have a Jew. The other thing about the fertilizers also is that what's recommended is that if you have to do it during the year, it's better to do it with your irrigation system, which, again, I'm not a gardener, so I cannot explain to you. But the same way they use sprinklers for, you know, watering, anything like that which can be done indirectly for fertilizing is also preferable than to do it directly yourself, like, you know, sprinkling it by hand. Okay, again, can't tell you exactly the details, but that's the general, again, same idea. What'd you say?
I think that's pretty standard.
Yeah, I think so. You're not familiar with it.
No.
Right. So if you can fertilize, you know, use the same irrigation system, that's the better way to do it because it's indirect. So it's less of a problem. Meaning it would be mutter if you needed to do it by hand or whatever else. But, you know, and the lesser, you know, the more minimizing of the type of the direct melacha that you can do, the better it is. That's what we spoke about last week also with the watering. Same thing. Generally speaking, sprinklers are usually more preferable to watering with a hose by hand because of the same idea. Okay. Next question, when it comes to pesticides, I don't know how many people use pesticides on a regular basis here, but it's something that if you need it in order to kill, you know, insects or whatever that are ruining your trees or whatever, so again, it's mutter. There are different, you know, discussions they have here. I don't think anybody here does this, but in professional places where they grow fruits for real, so, you know, for sale, for to market, so they have ways of covering, you know, netting or whatever, they can cover the fruits on the tree. So that's generally preferable to pesticide because you're not actually doing anything to the ground. Pesticides in the Mishnah is actually a discussion. It's called ma'ashnin in the Mishnah. Ma'ashnin is fumigation. Mm-hmm. So that's one of the melachas that's also asur d'rabbanan.
Is that an issue only if you want to do the pesticides for the fruit? Like, if you want to do the pesticides just because you don't like bugs?
So again, it's, you know, anything like that is going to be mutter. Okay. If it's done, I guess, for the fruit, there's more of a question of that maybe you do it better. You know, it's better to do it by putting netting on or something like that. But, you know, again, general, you know, rhesus type of things like that, which are clearly being done to ruin, you know, kill the insects rather than to help the ground. So in general, all those kind of things are going to be mutter. Okay. Again, pesticides, you know, rhesus type of pesticides, we know, is not, depending on where you are, it's not always something you can do. Right.
You can do it because
yeah. Happen. Yeah. Yeah. All they say again is if it's something that you're doing for the tree, so then if it was something you could
you
do.
You get an indirect benefit because the bugs will ruin the tree.
Correct. But again, those kind of things probably is permissible anyway. Let's see what else he says here. Yeah. Yeah. Again, we're not going to get into this now. There's a part of the machlokas, I already took aside for you. Not everybody holds that you can put on pesticides in order to prevent damage to the fruit. And everybody holds that you can do it for the tree. For the fruit is a machlokas. Because I was already taking the more mekel side, the Chazon Ish is mekel on that. I think Rav Kook and others are more machmir. They would say that if you're only using pesticides for the fruit, to prevent the fruit from getting damaged, that's more of a question. I mean, that might not be allowed. But again, most of us, when we're talking about that today, I don't know how many of us actually do that in our private gardens. Just for the fruit, you know, if it's more for the tree, then everybody would agree that that's probably mutter. Okay, next one. So there's another case in the Mishnah which is called misaklin. Misaklin is from the word samach kuf lamed. Skila, of course, we know skila is one of the four types of deaths that somebody who's chayav misa in the Torah says. Four types of deaths. Skila, of course, is stoning. So misaklin in the Mishnah in Shvius is an interesting term. It's also asur d'rabbanan. I want to take a guess at what it means. Yeah, exactly. That's right. That's what they say. Misaklin means to take the rocks and clean them away. So it's interesting. So the Mishnah is saying that it's asur d'rabbanan to clean your rocks in your in the field on Shemitah. Why is that asur? So the answer is, you could guess probably that. Yeah, exactly. Right. So that's preparation to plowing. Many times when you remove rocks, that's something that you'll do before you can plow properly. So therefore, the Mishnah says, again, it's not actual harisha. Actual plowing might be asur d'oraisa. It's a machlokas. But this is preparatory to that. So therefore, this is asur d'rabbanan. The question is, how does it apply when you're talking about a regular garden? Meaning, if you're not doing it to prepare the ground for plowing, you're doing it simply because you want your garden or your yard to look nice. Is it problematic to pick up rocks or to pick up anything else in your garden? Right? Very practical question. But again, the type of misaklin they're talking about is a very different type than most of us would do in our yard. So this is a very interesting point. So there's another Mishnah in Shvi'is, which says that it's actually mutter to take away rocks. And it seems that there, the Mefarshim explain, the case that they're saying it's mutter there is a case where it's done for construction, meaning not for the garden or for plowing the ground, but rather to build something. I mean, if you need to build something, and in order to build, you need to take away certain types of rocks to pick them up and make them into a structure or something. So then they say that's the case where maybe it's mutter. Based on that, again, we didn't get into all the details here, but just in terms of the basic point, based on that, there are some poskim, many poskim today, say that based on that, it's permissible to clean your garden. Why? Because if it's clear that you're taking rocks and clearing them away from your yard, not for agricultural purposes, but rather for, you know, to make your garden look aesthetically nice, or just so it should be clean, so then they say, just based on that Mishnah, of where it's permissible to take away the rocks, not for the plowing, but for other purposes, so it's permissible. That's where Shlomo Zalman Orbach suggests tentatively that maybe that's a reason to say that it's permissible. At the end of the day, he's not sure, meaning because the Mishnah says it's usher, so it's hard to say, well, it was only talking about this case and not that case. It's not absolute. He says it seems like it's okay, but he says tzarechin, it's not definite. However, Rav Tukachinsky, who was one of the big rabbanim in Yerushalayim 50 years ago or so, so in his sefer, I think it was him, in the sefer called Sefer HaShmita, he says it's mutter legamrei, meaning he says it's completely permissible for the same logic. And Rav Rimon and many other modern posts who basically say Allah l'maisa, that's permissible. For that point. However, what they point out is that you should make sure to only take away rocks and other things in your garden in a way where it's normally done only for cleanliness. Meaning you shouldn't do it in a way which could be either that it looks like or that it would be done for actually preparing the ground for plowing. Meaning, again, I'm not a gardener and I'm not a plower. So you know, if it's like little rocks done in a way that will really make the ground smooth for plowing, then it might be more problematic. But if it's, you know, big rocks or annoying things or certainly garbage or things like that in your garden, or, you know, straight twigs or leaves, right, things like that. So Lamaisa, they say generally that that's permissible if it's clear to anybody, you know, to others that it's done for cleanliness. They usually say that it's best to do it by hand, which I think in most of our cases that's the case. But again, if you're professional, it could be that.
So this includes things like leaves, pollen, yeah. Flowers.
Yeah, correct. All those things. But again, it has to be done clearly in a way which shows that you're doing it only for cleanliness and not for agricultural purposes.
So you use one of those outside vacuums?
So that already, again, that in my mind might not be so, might be better to it. It's easier to do it that way, but I'm not sure. Meaning, if you ask a gardener, would they tell you that anybody might actually use that in order to do it the real way, meaning to prepare the ground for plowing, like for agricultural purposes, or that's only done?
Vacuum cleaner.
Right, I'm saying, is that something which is a professional tool used in agriculture, or it's something which, to be honest, again, I don't know, I should know, I don't know, I didn't see it discussed here, but probably any gardener would be able to tell you. My guess is that would be more of a question. I mean, my guess is that it's better to do it by hand. Not for sure that the post would say it's better to do it by hand, because it's clear that you're doing it. But again, maybe it's not practical to pick up all your leaves by hand. Maybe that's already a lot of work. Talking about rocks and talking about twigs and, you know, garbage, that's pretty easy to do it by hand. It's preferable. Talking about a lot of leaves, then you have to find out whether that's something, that type of device is something which is used professionally as well, you know, to help grow the garden or just to make it clean.
What about moving something before you mow the lawn?
Again, I think the poskim say, and I didn't discuss this, Rav Daniel discussed, I think, the week that he did this year. I don't know if you were there. He spoke a little bit about mowing the lawn. In general, I think Rav Rimon says, and others say, that if you're doing it together with mowing the lawn, that actually might be better. Because if you're mowing the lawn in a way which is permissible, which again is a bit of a discussion, but the bottom line is that it usually is assumed to be permissible to mow the lawn. Maybe not every day, but at a regular amount of time, that not too much, but enough time that the lawn will be cut and won't grow more after you mow it. Okay, meaning that I think he discussed. But there's problems. You mow the lawn, you know, less frequently, like too infrequently, then it could be every time you mow the lawn that causes the grass to grow more, which is more of a problem. Mowing the lawn, which is permissible according to many poskim, is when it's done on a more regular basis, but not too often, in a way which just maintains the level of the grass so that, you know, you're giving it a haircut. And that's generally permissible. In that case, I think Rav Rimon says and others say that if you're doing it together with mowing the lawn, so then it's clear that you're doing it to keep, I guess for upkeep, you would call it, to keep the garden looking nice and not for agricultural purposes. That actually might even be better, to do it together with mowing the lawn. Right, exactly. I mean, it's obvious to everybody that you're doing it not for agricultural reasons, but rather just to keep it looking, you know, tidy. And then, you know, that's one of the options they suggest, maybe to do it together with mowing the lawn, so that's clear. But I think it's mutter even if you're not, as long as it's clear that what you're doing is just picking up a couple things around rather than doing anything more extensive than that. Okay. Any questions other than that? Good. Okay, next point. That's basically the end of the most of the gardening things that I was going to speak about. Again, you can look up Rav Rimon's book. Would you? Ah, that's why you're right. I knew there was something else that I didn't prepare to. I knew this. I apologize. I didn't put it together. We could speak about it very quickly, but I didn't. I didn't put together like a whole outline. It's actually a whole interesting discussion. The bottom line is that, put it this way: if you have a plant outside, is more of a question. To plant outside, even in a potted plant, is potentially a problem during Shemitah. If you do it inside on the floor, so. If it's on the second floor, most poskim are makel.
I mean, like window boxes.
Yeah. So anything like that, which is not directly on the ground, there's more room to be makel in terms of that. Again, maybe when we go over some of these halachas again in a few months, maybe I'll discuss it in a more detailed way. Again, I apologize. I knew there was something else I was trying to do today, and I completely forgot. Couldn't remember what it was. If it's on the floor, it's more of a question. Why is that? So again, without getting into all the details.
On the floor, as in
so this is where it gets interesting. Okay, this is where it gets interesting. There's a concept, I think maybe we mentioned it, I don't remember, about atitz nukuv and atitz shein nukuv. Anybody remember if we mentioned this at some point?
Yeah.
Mentioned it? Okay. We have basically, what'd you say? Yeah, you're right. You learned this in Hilchos Shavuos, or?
At some point. No.
Interesting. All right, very good. It's not usually discussed so much in Hilchos Shavuos either, even though it's obviously it's on the books and the Gemara is based on Shavuos. It's not like the first thing that you learn in Hilchos Shavuos, not the place that I've been. So that's where the Gemara is. Basically, atitz nukuv and atitz shein nukuv are basically potted plants. Okay, nukuv is basically a plant which has a hole. A hole which the roots can go straight into the ground. And as a shein nukuv is a plant which does not have a hole. So in terms of Hilchos Shabbos, they discuss that atitz shein nukuv is still an issur d'rabbanan. Meaning, if you would either plant or detach or pull out a plant which is in a pot, even if there's no hole which connects the roots in the plant to the ground, it's still issur d'rabbanan. Okay, it's still considered to be planting and cutting mid'rabbanan. The same thing is true when it comes to other mitzvahs of Tchilas Baretz, Shemitah, Kalayim, and Truma. They generally assume that a potted plant without a hole is considered to be midrabanan, like it's attached to the ground. When it comes to Shemitah, they don't talk about it, meaning it's not mentioned in the Gemara, it's not mentioned in the Rambam. So the poskim discuss, well, what's the halacha? Meaning, do you treat Shemitah also that it's in Issur Drabanan, meaning that if you have a potted plant which does not have a hole, then your midrabanan, you would not be allowed to plant that during Shemitah. And you would not be allowed to water it, and the same rules we had before about that. You would not be allowed to pull it out, whatever it is. Is that the halacha? Or do we say, no, if it wasn't mentioned, maybe Chazal never made any gzeiras. This or Drabbanan is only cases where it's more frequent. But Shemitah only comes once every 7 years. Maybe they didn't make any decree about an atitz shein nukuv during Shemitah. Okay, this is where it gets interesting. So Lemaisa, some of the poskim decide that they want to be makil. Shlomo Zalman wants to try to be makil, but in the end he shows proofs that maybe you can't be makil. It's very, the whole thing is a bit ambiguous, which is why we can't really focus on it completely now. The bottom line is that Shlomo Zalman is actually machmir if it's on the ground, unless you have an additional piece underneath. What did you say?
A separation.
Right. So meaning, in addition to the pot itself, if you also have one of these plates, I think, that goes underneath it, and it's on the ground, and, again, this is not for now, but and the plant itself doesn't stretch outside of the pot. I mean, for example, if you look at these flowers here, so the flowers go outside of the vase. Okay, the vase is right in the middle. The flowers already go this way and that way and all over. So if you take that image, I don't know if you have a plant here like that, but if you take that image and apply it to a plant, so a plant that looks like that, so already, again, it's hard to understand, but the poskim are generally machmir.
Plants are not going to be.
You're right. So in a chanami, so that's why. What did you say?
No, it's maybe a cactus.
Right, correct.
Maybe a cactus is the only exception. Anything's going
to
be over.
You're right. So that's why I think they say that, again, if it's like that, there's more of a reason to say that you need to be machmer during Shemitah and not to plant during Shemitah. And also in terms of watering, they have to follow the rules that we mentioned before in terms of water. You can't just water as much as you want. However, Rav Shlomo Zalman and others say that if it's not on the first floor, it's on the second floor already, maybe there's more room to make ill. Maybe on a window sill might be more room to make ill. Again, I'm not going to get into the details now just because I apologize I didn't prepare it to be precise. But again, if you want to see it before next month, so Rav Rimon has a nice little piece about it here in the old version. I'll tell you where it is here if
so
you have the book.
It's not the land, it's not Eretz Yisrael. It's not the land of Eretz Yisrael.
Correct.
Meaning, it could physically be dirt that came from Eretz Yisrael.
Correct.
It
means you're
like,
abundant. Right. Meaning
on your third floor.
Right. Well,
but it's Eretz Yisrael. I mean,
no, the third floor might be better. On the first floor is the question.
No, I'm saying, because you're saying if it's separated and it's not,
right.
It's not the land of Eretz Yisrael anymore.
Right. Correct. Correct. Meaning, Chazal's Gezerah.
It doesn't matter the actual. Is.
Correct. I mean, it's the ground.
It's the
Correct.
Concept of the ground.
Exactly. It's the ground of Eretz Yisrael. Yeah, it's interesting. You have to think about it. But again, once the soil is detached from the ground, it's not considered to be the ground anymore. The only thing is, again, the Chazal made this gezeira, they made this decree, that anything which is on the ground but is separated from the ground, maybe midirabban, we have to be more exactly right. So that's why they say on the first floor, if the plant goes out, then maybe there's more to be machmir about it. Again, if you want to see, I could pass it around now. You can look at some of the pictures here. They have he's got a whole discussion here about it here, again, which we're not going to get into now. I'm going to apologize. I can find it for you here.
But the opposite isn't true. Let's say you take dirt and you bring it to Kutzlaris, it still has the Kedusha of the Registra.
In a certain sense, yes, but if you put it in the ground, it doesn't mean that you have to take Trumas and Masra, so the Mitzvah Bar, if it's
right. I just mean, like, you know, at the end of seminary, yeah. You're like, oh,
right, it's like one of those things, right, I think it's more of a symbolic rather than halachic.
Yeah.
Here, if you want to look here, he's got a few pictures here. Again, in terms of the halakhic aspects of, you know, keeping, you know, right, for true, you know, right. Correct, it doesn't. And it depends on where it's grown. If it's grown in the soil in Chutz Laaretz, even if the soil from Eretz Yisrael comes there first, it doesn't matter. It's not included. There's more of a question in that case that maybe it might be a problem. Because it's something that you would want, that you would benefit from. If it's somewhere else, maybe not. In addition, again, what Adina mentioned, you know, the question of Shabbos, we have halachas of psik reisha, v'nichale or lo-nichale. If you do something, let's say you open up your refrigerator and the light goes on inside, so we know that's a problem. Even though you didn't turn on the light, you open the door, but it's what's called psik reisha. If you do one action and it immediately causes another action to happen as a direct result, that's problematic when it comes to Shabbos. If you don't want the result, I mean, if you didn't want the light to go on, then maybe there's more room to be lenient, but there's a lot of discussion, big machlokas, whatever. So here also it's a similar question, okay? Similar question, if you're doing something which maybe automatically will cause the water to go onto the ground, but let's say, not the case where you wash your hands, but let's say the case where you, let's say, sweep the water outside. Okay, you didn't put the water on the grass directly, you swept it out, and then it trickles, you know, down your patio or whatever, and into the grass. So that also, it's going to happen, it's, you know, if you do it in a certain way. But yeah, you didn't do it directly. So is that secretion of the nichalei, lo nichalei? What's the halacha in terms of Shemitah? Shabbos, there's one halacha. Is it the same halacha in terms of Shemitah or not? These factors are all considered when it comes to halacha. You're not going to go into all the sources inside because there's actually not so many sources about it, believe it or not. Very interesting. They didn't talk about it so much in the olden days, I guess. The bottom line is that it's a machlokas, right? What are people saying? So Rav Yashiv is quoted in a few places as saying that it's usher. And Rav Yashiv says that you have to try really hard in all these cases to avoid it. Meaning if you have a pipe that goes into your yard, you try to take your pipe and put it somewhere else, that doesn't fall straight into the yard. If you have pools and water fights or whatever, you should try very, very hard, if it's in your own yard at least, try very, very hard that you don't spill it out in a place where it's gonna help your garden, help your grass grow or whatever. Certainly, in a case where you're washing your hands directly on the grass, which I guess is similar to the kiddie pool, if you're doing it directly onto the garden, then it's more problematic. However, there are many poskim that are makil in some of these cases. I saw in some of the Sfarim here the quote of Karel, it's from B'nai Brak, and the Chazon Ish also, I think, was more makil. Essentially, what they say is because you have a few factors together, meaning, number one, the normal method of watering is not pouring pools and, you know, taking hoses from your air conditioner or sweeping, you know, shtifa with your, you know, your thing or whatever, and sweeping that into the garden. That's not a normal method of watering. So that's number one. It's not the regular method. It's sort of like kilachar yad. It's unusual. Number two, it wasn't your kavana. So again, that may not make it mutter, but that's definitely a factor if that's not your intention. So maybe that's going to be more lenient. Number three, we mentioned also that watering is not a melacha d'oraisa. Watering is only drabanan. That's another factor to be more lenient. And number four, as we mentioned before, also, it's not, some of these cases at least, are not direct. And in the cases that are not direct, if it's not directly watered straight on the garden, again, there's more room to be lenient. So lach l'maisa, personally, I think you can be makil. On many of these, on the cases that are not direct, you could definitely be makil, and you can follow all the points we just mentioned to be more lenient, which means, again, if you have things, you know, water coming from your house, you sweep it out, whatever, think all those cases there's room to be lenient. However, it seems that even those that are lenient are more machmer if you do it directly. So therefore, washing your hands on the garden, pouring the water from the pool out on the garden, again, if you would call it a shas of the chak, that it's very extenuating circumstances, maybe there's room to be lenient. Because there are enough factors here, but l'chachila, it seems like everybody would agree that it's best to avoid those cases. Where do you pour your water? I don't know. You got to find, you know, pour it on the concrete, concrete in your driveway, whatever. What'd you say?
A lot more wasted water.
That's true. What are you going to do when it's Shemitah? You know what? But let me just give you one other option, which is very important, and you might actually have thought of this yourself. We mentioned before. We mentioned this last time, but I mentioned it again tonight. Is watering always forbidden? No, we said watering is sometimes permitted. When is watering permitted? Right. Exactly, right. So basically whatever it is, once a week instead of twice a week, however long, you know, if it's a minimal amount. So maybe wait to give your kids a kitty, you know, to give them the pool. You know, if you go to water your garden once a week during Shemitah, so instead of watering the garden, you know, completely take some of the water from this, spill it in this area of the garden, and then the rest of it can get watered or something like that. I'm not sure exactly, but if it's a case where, you know, where there's room to be lenient to water the ground anyway, so then it would also be okay to do it in one of these ways. Okay, even the ways of pouring it directly out would be permissible. But if it's a time of year, or, you know, a time after it was already watered, that you can't argue that it still needs more water right now, so then, you know, there's more to machmir about it. Mm-hmm. Any questions on that point?
So then you can't just take your leftover water from your water jug and pour it onto your plant in Shemitah?
It depends on the halacha of watering the plants during Shemitah, which may depend on where it is, which we've mentioned before. I mean, if it's permissible to water the plant, then that might be okay. But if it's not permissible, then you would only be able to do it enough to make it, you know, that it wouldn't die.
Survive.
Okay, to survive. Which again is going to be mutter, you know, that at least that will be mutter. But to water on a regular basis, that's going to be based on what we said before, which is some of the questions about how far up it goes and where on the ground it is and which sheet to which opinion you hold like, etc., etc. Okay, last point in terms of this before we finish up. This is not so relevant here in Yad Binyamin, but it's good to be aware of it because it is an important point in many other places in this country. What happens if you live in an apartment building? Okay, great. Apartment buildings are very nice. The question is, what happens if the rest of your neighbors in the apartment are not necessarily religious? So those of you who may have lived in apartments at some point know that there's such a thing called a vad bayit. Heard of it?
Yeah.
So vad bayit basically means that there's, you know, everybody contributes a little bit of money to the upkeep of either the garden or, you know, the stair or the cleaning, whatever it is. What did
you
say? So you owe a little bit of money. But during Shemitah, the problem is if some of your neighbors are not frum, they may insist on having, you know, the vad bayit money go to what it normally goes to, which is to upkeep of the garden. But you can't allow that because what they may do probably will be a little bit more that it'll be permitted halachically during Shemitah. So what do you do in that case?
You're mafkir, you're failing.
Oh, very good. As you know. Yeah. Excellent. So you guys think, okay, very good. So Adina, she got it right on. The first thing you do is try to convince them that maybe they should try to cut down their... Exactly. Right. Start with the kiyuv, okay? So nice, exactly right. Give them some nice cake, okay? You want more cake? Do what I want during Shemitah. Nah, just kidding. Don't do that. You try to convince them. You tell them there's something which is, you know, important to you. And you would be very thrilled if they would help you out and, you know, follow, you know, Shemitah. It's nice. It's green. You know, they have this thing. If you look on Google and YouTube these days in Hebrew, there's these videos called Shemitah Yisraelit, where they're not necessarily looking at Shemitah as a halachic, they're looking at it as a nice green thing for the environment, you know. I'll talk to them about, you know, some of the ideas, but if it doesn't work, so then basically what you can do is first you should declare that your money, I mean your vad bayit money, is not going for the extra watering or the upkeep of the garden in a way which would be not permissible. Your money is going for other aspects of the vad bayit in the house or the building or whatever it is. In addition to that, you have to make sure that you're not, you know, a partner to their Shemitah gardening, which would be problematic. So basically you need to be, as you know, you have to be mafkir. You're part of the garden by basically saying, get three people in front of you, and basically say in front of three people that I am hereby denouncing my ownership of my portion of the garden during this year of Shemitah. It's basically the way that that the postum recommend doing it in these types of situations. Again, for most of us here, that's not so relevant, but it's good to be aware of the question, and it is a question in many other places. It's a good question, but again, if you take away your ownership, though, then it's probably okay. Meaning it's not yours anymore, then it's perfectly fine. That's why that's an important aspect of that. Okay, any other questions about anything else Shemitah related before we just wrap up with some Tisha B'Av stuff? No. Okay. B'seder. So let's wrap up with a little bit about Tisha B'Av, just being that Tisha B'Av is tomorrow night. So you think about it, is there a connection between Shemitah and Tisha B'Av? And the answer is definitely yes. Anybody know what it is? Any connections? Anything? Okay, so that's... Okay. Okay, excellent. So you're both on to some of the connections here. Let me share with you a couple points you can keep in mind. Number one, so the Torah, when the Torah says in the Tochacha, in all the curses in Parashat Pechukotai, so the Torah goes through all the bad things that are going to happen to the Jewish people if they don't keep the mitzvos. So one of the things, I don't have a chumash open in front of me, but one of the things that the Torah says is during the time of exile, when the Jews get exiled, Oz Tirtzeh Ha'aretz et Shav Totah. At that point, then the land is going to rest. And they say, what's going on here? What are you talking about? So Rashi and Chazal basically say there that part of the punishment of exile, of Galus, is because of the fact that the Jews didn't keep Shemitah. Meaning that because the Jews continued to work their land, basically, I forgot, one of you said that, because during the Shemitah years, they kept working in the land when they weren't supposed to, so the land will essentially take back its years of rest during the years when the Jews are in exile. What's interesting about it, Chazal point out, is that the year, how many years during, at least between the first temple and the second temple were there? It was 7-year exile, right? How many Shemitah years, according to the calculation of Chazal, how many Shemitah years were there during the Bayis Rishon that supposedly that weren't kept? Again, I can't verify this, but Chazal say that supposedly there were 70 Shemitah years during that time. You work it out. So every Shemitah year is, I think it's actually a little more than that, because 70 years Shemitah would be 490 years. Maybe it's 420. I can't say it works exactly. Maybe it's from the amount of time from when they came into Eretz Yisrael in the first place. That's also doesn't quite work. Okay, I don't remember exactly how it works. But basically, they say that there is some sort of correspondence between the number of years they didn't keep Shemitah completely and the number of years of the exile. But that idea that the exile was partially based on the fact that Jews didn't keep Shemitah, the land didn't rest, so they were punished by forcing the land to rest. That's the first important point when it comes to Shemitah. You find in the Tish B'Av literature, this point comes up a few times, again, which is very fascinating, because Shemitah is an important mitzvah. But when you think about what we all know, the Chazal, you know, the Gemara talks about the first temple being destroyed because of idolatry, Avodah Zarah, Gilei Arayos, and Shfichus Damim, murder. And the second temple, they talk about Sinas Chinam, you know, hatred. Where does Shemitah come from? But yet, Chazal say a number of times that Shemitah was a very important sin that caused the Galus in a certain way. So just a couple points here very quickly, if you don't mind. So in Perek Aleph, Pasuk Tes in Eicha. So the Torah says, the Navi says here, I'm sorry, it's Pasuk Zion. Says, Zachar Yerushalayim Yimei Anya Umurudeha Kol Machmudeha Asher Hayu Yimei Kedem Bin Ful Amah Biad Sor Ve'en Ozer La. Yerushalayim remembered all the days of its while it was in exile. It remembered all the good times that it had, you know, previously before the destruction. How it was destroyed by the enemies. Bin Ful Amah Biad Sor. It fell in the hands of the enemies. Ve'en Ozer La. Nobody helped it. Reuat Sarim Sachaku Al Mishpatecha. The Sarim, those the adversaries saw it. Sachaku Al Mishpatecha. They rejoiced, sachek, to laugh, to rejoice, al mishpateha, over the fact that shavta, that something stopped. The question is, what stopped here? So some of the farshim say that stop means that the simcha stopped, there was no more rejoicing. But Rashi and Eicha, you could look it up afterwards, Rashi and another parish in that pasuk basically says the following. He says, the non-Jews were laughing at the Jews, they said, shotim, you silly people! Okay, when you were in Eretz Yisrael, you didn't keep Shemitah, lo shamatatem. And now you're in exile, now you have no choice, now you got to keep Shemitah. Okay, when you were Baritzachem lo shemartim va'achshav v'gola tishmeru, you have no choice. Now that you're in exile, you're out of Eretz Yisrael, you have to keep Shemitah because there's no land to keep it. There's no land to work anymore. So again, if the non-Jews realize that, then certainly the Jews have to realize that part of what happened here, part of the exile, took place because of not keeping Shemitah. If you look again, not now, but during Tisha B'Av, take a look at the kinas, the whole series of kinas during the daytime. On Tisha B'Av that we say, take a look at the first one in the daytime kinos. It's kina number 6. It's called Shavas. Okay, Shavas Sur Menishim Uni. Shavas means it stopped. Everything just stopped. It's based on a pasuk later on in Eichon Perek Hay. And the explanation some give is Shavas is based on the word Shabbos. Okay, Shavas means stopped. What's Shabbos about? Shabbos is about a day of rest. What's Shemitah called in the Torah? Shabbos LaHashem is called a year of rest for God. And what happened on Tisha B'Av? Galus comes, and suddenly everything stops. There's no more temple, there's no more Kohanim and Levim, there's no more working of the land, everything suddenly comes to a grinding halt. And that's why you could think about Tisha B'Av in a certain sense, of the temple being destroyed, that there's a lot of activity, and everything's bubbling, everything's happening, and suddenly, one fell swoop, one day, comes Nebuchadnezzar, or in the second temple, the Romans, and everything's finished. The temple's in flames, everything suddenly comes to a halt. But it's not the halt of Shabbos, it's not the halt of Shemitah, of not working the land, it's the halt of exile, of the enemies coming, destroying everything. And here also, it's so ironic that the same point we had before, you want to make sure that Shemitah is kept at the right time, so that you're not forced to keep Shemitah at the wrong time, when we're kicked out of exile, there's no Shemitah to keep anymore. In Kina number 10, again, you'll look this up later if you want to write it down, Kina number 10, also during the daytime, look at the Kinas. So this Kina is called, we're not going to read the whole thing now, obviously, but it's called Echa Yashua Chavateles HaSharon. Okay, Echa, how is it possible that the Jewish people were desolate like Chavateles HaSharon, they started as a rose, and then suddenly everything went silent, the rose went bad, went dried up, whatever it is. So they talk about all these different cases, things that went wrong in the temple. Things in the temple were stopped. So in the third stanza in Kina number 10, it says, Golso me'artza kala mekushata. Okay, the Jews, represented by a kala, by a bride, who was adorned with jewelry, were exiled from their land. Ba'avon ma'asros u'shmita. Because of the sin of ma'asros, of not taking truman ma'aser, and the sin of shmita. Again, interesting point. Shmita is mentioned here as one of the direct sins which caused the exile. And basically, the Mefarshim reference here a famous Mishnah, Pirkei Avos. In chapter 5 of Pirkei Avos, the Mishnah says that galus bal le'olam al shmitas haaretz, that exile comes to the world because of shmita. And what they say basically, the Medrash in Eicha also says in, I think, Perek Beis, the Medrash in Eicha says basically the same idea, that the reason the Jews had to move out of Eretz Yisrael is for this point. Exile comes to the world because of Shemitah, because they didn't keep Shemitah properly. Again, Kina 31, same thing. This is the Kina that we sing. I don't know if you're familiar with this, but it's the one, B'tesim Mitzrayim, B'tesim Yerushalayim. It's got a nice tune that we sing to it. So there also, we say, right in the middle of that Kina as well, we say, Yovel u'shmita, it's alphabetical, it goes Aleph, Bet, Gimel, Dalet. So Yud is Yovel u'shmita ve'eretz shoketa. That through Yovel and Shmita, the land was shoketa, was quiet. Meaning that during the time the Jews were in Eretz Yisrael after leaving Egypt, so they kept Yovel and Shmita, and the land was quiet, everything was good. Okay, Shalva, Menucha, everything was restful. And then when they left Yerushalayim, B'tesim Yerushalayim, Machul Tzmisus, they were sold away as slaves because they cut off. So again, the idea that if you keep Shemitah properly, the land will rest, everything will be quiet the way that it's supposed to be. What's going on here? I mean, what's the connection between Shemitah and exile and Tisha B'Av? What's the conceptual point behind it? Why is Shemitah so important? So here I think there's two points you can mention, and we'll conclude with this. Number one, I saw an explanation from the Shemi Shmuel, the Sukkah Chopper. So he suggests the following. He says that the soil of Eretz Yisrael is blessed with a divine source, meaning Hashem looks out for the land of Eretz Yisrael. It's special blessing from Hashem to make the soil here grow the way that it does. And he says that if we don't keep Shemitah and the other mitzvot that have to do with the land, then that special divine connection to the land which makes it grow, that connection disintegrates. It's gone. And that causes the Jews to go into exile. So number one, we lose the divine connection of ourselves to the land. We have to leave. And number two, you look at the land itself. It's desolate. There's no growth in this country when we're not here. And just look at the last 2,000 years of exile. You see it. It's amazing. And you look at now, we come back, and suddenly everything is blooming again. An amazing point. But according to the Shemi Shmuel, that's the point, that we have to keep Shemitah to recognize that the special divine source of the land is coming from HaKadosh Baruch Hu here in Eretz Yisrael, in order to be able to merit to have this land to continue to keep it. Number two, really a similar point, but just to add to that a little bit, if you think about Shemitah, we mentioned this already a couple weeks ago, what is part of the point of Shemitah? What is Shemitah all about? And we mentioned one of the main discussions that the commentaries have about Shemitah is the fact that Shemitah is supposed to remind us that HaKadosh Baruch Hu is in charge, meaning that Hashem is the one that owns the land, it's not us. And this was something that the Jews at the time when the temple was destroyed, they sort of forgot this. Okay, they forgot that, the temple's always going to be here. Let's offer sacrifices and not really have in mind what it's going for. We'll continue to kill people and hurt people and this and that and hate each other. And as long as we offer sacrifices, God won't do anything to us because we have our temple. The answer is no. The point of Shemitah is to remember that HaKadosh Baruch Hu wants us to recognize that everything comes from Him. It's not taken for granted that we have a temple. We can never take for granted that we're here. And we see today, we're fighting for our spiritual, our national lives here in Eretz Yisrael during this time of war. We have to remember that's all based on HaKadosh Baruch Hu. And that's what the point of Shemitah is all about, to remember that if we can't work the land, we're not working the land because of the fact that it's not ours. And if we remember that, so then hopefully Hashem won't have to throw us into galus. We won't have exile if we remember that we're here because Hashem wants us to be here. So God willing, we should, Tisha B'Av should turn into a holiday, but if we're still here tomorrow night, without the new temple being built yet, hopefully think about some of these lessons of galus, of exile, and part of the message we want to get out of Shemitah, of coming back to keeping the land, letting the land rest when it's supposed to rest, thinking of the divine connection, and trying to keep Shemitah as best as we can, halakhically, to the best of our abilities. Hopefully that should be part of the impetus. And this is what the Shem Yishmael says also. Not only is the lack of Shemitah an impetus to exile, to Golus, but keeping Shemitah hopefully can be an impetus to a quicker Geulah. If we can keep Shemitah properly, then hopefully the redemption will be able to come that much faster. And we should be able to be zochah to Mashiach speedily in our days. Yashar Koach.